then the stony organs, and then the last parts of the hook-nosed magician crumbled away, leaving behind only a small, conical mound of powder rising out of the pool of water that had once sustained its life. Roran looked over at Khan's corpse, then looked away just as quickly, unable to bear the sight. "At least you had your revenge on him." Then he put aside thoughts of his slain friend, for they were too painful to dwell on, and instead concentrated upon the most immediate problem at hand. The soldiers at the southern end of the square, who were slowly picking themselves up off the ground. Roran saw the Varden doing much the same.
"Oi!" he shouted. "With me! We'll never have a better chance than now!"
He pointed at some of his men who were obviously wounded.
"Help them up and put them in the center of the formation! No one gets left behind! No one!"
His lips and mouth throbbed as he spoke, and his head ached as if he had been up all night drinking. The Varden rallied at the sound of his voice and hurried to join him. As the men gathered into a broad column behind him, Roran took his place in the foremost rank of warriors, between Baldur and Delwyn, both of whom bore bloody scrapes from the explosion.
"Khan is dead?"
Baldur asked. Roran nodded and lifted his shield, as did the other men, so that they formed a solid, outward-facing wall.
"Then we'd better hope Halsted doesn't have another magician hidden away somewhere," Delwyn muttered.
When the Varden were all in place, Roran shouted,
"Forward march!"
And the warriors tramped across the remainder of the courtyard. Whether because their leadership was less effective than the Varden's, or because the blast had dealt them a more severe blow, the Empire's soldiers had failed to recover as quickly, and so were still disorganized when the Varden drove into their midst. Roran grunted and staggered back a step as a spear embedded itself in his shield, numbing his arm and dragging it down through sheer weight. Reaching around, he swept his hammer across the face of the shield. It bounced off the haft of the spear, which refused to budge. A soldier in front of him, perhaps the very one who had thrown the spear, seized the opportunity to run at him and swing his sword at Roran's neck. Roran started to lift his shield, along with the spear lodged in it, but it was too heavy and cumbersome for him to protect himself with. So he used his hammer instead, lashing out at the descending sword. On edge, however, the blade was almost impossible for him to see, and he timed his parry badly and missed the sword with his hammer. He would have died then, except that his knuckles clipped the flat of the blade, deflecting it several inches to the side. A line of fire cut through Roran's right shoulder. Jagged bolts of lightning shot down his side, and his vision flashed bright yellow. His right knee buckled, and he fell forward. Stone underneath him, feet and legs around him, hemming him in so he could not roll away to safety. His whole body sluggish and unresponsive, as if he were trapped in honey.
Too slow, he thought, as he struggled to free his arm from the shield and get his feet back under him.
If he stayed on the ground, he would either be stabbed or trampled.
Too slow.
Then he saw the soldier collapse in front of him, clutching at his belly, and a second later someone pulled Roran up by the collar of his hauberk and held him upright while he regained his footing. It was Baldur. Twisting his neck, Roran looked at where the soldier had struck him. 5 links in his mail shirt had split open, but other than that, the armor had held. Despite the blood oozing out of the rent and the pain that racked his neck and arm, he did not think the wound was life-threatening, nor was he about to stop and find out. His right arm still worked, at least enough to continue fighting, and that was all he cared about at the moment. Someone passed him a replacement shield. He grimly shouldered it and pressed onward with his men, forcing the soldiers to retreat along the wide street that led from the square. The soldiers soon broke and ran in the face of the Varden's overwhelming strength, fleeing down the myriad side streets and alleys that branched off the thoroughfare. Roran paused then, and sent 50 of his men back to close the portcullis and sallyport, and to guard them against any foes who might seek to follow the Varden into the heart of Aros. Most of the soldiers in the city would be stationed close to the outer wall to repel besiegers, and Roran had no desire to face them in open battle. To do so would be suicidal, given the size of Hallstatt's forces.
The Varden met little resistance thereafter, as they progressed through the inner city to the large, well-appointed palace where Lord Halstead ruled. A spacious courtyard with an artificial pond, wherein swam geese and white swans, lay before the palace, which towered several stories above the rest of Aros. The palace was a beautiful, ornate structure of open arches, colonnades, and wide balconies intended for dancing and parties. Unlike the castle in the heart of Bellatona, it had obviously been built with pleasure in mind, not defense. They must have assumed no one could get past their walls, thought Roran. Several dozen guards and soldiers in the courtyard charged haphazardly at the Varden when they caught sight of them, shouting war cries the whole while. "Stay in formation!" Roran ordered, as the men rushed toward them. For a minute or two, the sound of clashing arms filled the courtyard. The geese and the swans honked with alarm at the commotion and beat the water with their wings, but none of them dared leave the confines of their pond. It did not take long for the Varden to rout the soldiers and guards. Then they stormed the entryway of the palace, which was so richly decorated with paintings on the walls and ceilings, as well as gilt mouldings, carved furniture, and a patterned floor, that Roran found it difficult to take in all at once. The wealth required to build and maintain such an edifice was more than he could comprehend. The entire farm where he had grown up had not been equal to the worth of a single chair in that grand hall. Through an open doorway, he saw three serving women running down another long corridor as fast as their skirts would allow. "Don't let them get away!" he exclaimed. Five swordsmen broke off from the main body of the Varden and dashed after the women, catching them before they reached the end of the passageway. The women uttered piercing screams and struggled ferociously, clawing at their captors, as the men dragged them back to where Roran was waiting. "Enough!" shouted Roran when they were in front of him, and the women ceased fighting, although they continued to whimper and moan. The oldest of the three, a stout matron who had her silver hair pulled back in an untidy bun and who carried a ring of keys at her waist, appeared the most reasonable. So Roran asked her, "Where is Lord Halstead?" The woman stiffened and lifted her chin. "Do with me what you will, sir, but I'll not betray my master." Roran moved toward her until they were only a foot apart. "Listen to me, and listen well," he growled. "Aros has fallen, and you and everyone else in this city are at my mercy. Nothing you can do will change that. Tell me where Halstead is, and we'll let you and your companions go. You can't save him from his doom, but you can save yourselves." His torn lips were so swollen he was barely able to make himself understood, and with every word, flecks of blood flew from his mouth. "My own fate doesn't matter, sir," said the woman, her expression as determined as any warrior's. Roran cursed and slapped his hammer against his shield, producing a harsh crash that echoed loudly in the cavernous hall. The women flinched at the sound. "Have you taken leave of your senses? Is Halstead worth your life? Is the Empire? Is Galbatorix?" "I don't know about Galbatorix or the Empire, sir, but Halstead has always been kind enough to us serving folk, and I'll not see him strung up by the likes of you. Filthy, ungrateful muck, that's what you are." "Is that so?" He stared at her fiercely. "How long do you think you can hold your tongue if I decide to let my men wring the truth out of you?" "You'll never make me talk," she declared, and he believed her. "What about them?" He nodded toward the other women, the youngest of whom could not have been more than 17. "Are you willing to let them be cut into pieces just to save your master?" The woman sniffed disdainfully, then said, "Lord Halstead is in the east wing of the palace. Take the corridor over there, go through the yellow room and Lady Galliana's flower garden, and you'll find him sure as rain." Roran listened with suspicion. A capitulation seemed too quick and too easy, given her earlier resistance. Also, while she spoke, he noticed that the other two women reacted with surprise and some other emotion he could not identify. Confusion? He wondered. In any event, they did not react the way he would have expected if the silver-haired woman had just delivered their lord into the arms of their enemies. They were too quiet. too subdued, as if they were hiding something. Of the two, the girl was the less skilled at masking her feelings, so Roran turned on her with all the savagery he could muster.
"You there! She's lying, isn't she? Where is Halsted? Tell me!"
The girl opened her mouth and shook her head, speechless. She tried to back away from him, but one of the warriors held her in place.
Roran stomped over to her, jammed his shield flat against her chest, knocking the air out of her, and leaned his weight against it, pinning her between him and the man behind her. Lifting his hammer, Roran touched it to the side of her cheek. "You're rather pretty, but you'll have a hard time finding anyone but old men to court you if I knock out your front teeth. I lost a tooth myself today, but I managed to put it back in. See?"
And he spread his lips in what he was sure was a gruesome approximation of a smile.
"I'll keep your teeth, though, so you won't be able to do the same. And make a fine trophy, eh?"
And he made a threatening motion with the hammer. The girl cringed and cried,
"No, please, sir, I don't know, please. He was in his quarters, meeting with his captains. But then he and Lady Galliana were going to go to the tunnel to the docks and—"
"Thara, you fool!" exclaimed the matron.
"There's a ship waiting for them. There is, and I don't know where he is now. But please don't hit me. I don't know anything else, sir, and—"
"His quarters," barked Roran. "Where are they?"
Sobbing, the girl told him.
"Let them go," he said when she finished.
And the three women darted out of the entryway, the hard heels of their shoes clattering against the polished floor. Roran led the Varden through the enormous building in accordance with the girl's instructions. Scores of half-dressed men and women crossed their paths, but none paused to fight. The palace rang with shouts and screams, to the point where he wanted to plug his ears with his fingers. Partway to their destination, they came upon an atrium with a statue of a huge black dragon in the middle. Roran wondered if it was supposed to be Galbatorix's dragon Shrukan. As they trooped past the statue, Roran heard a twang, and then something struck him in the back. He fell against a stone bench next to the path and clutched at it.
Pain! Agonizing, thought-destroying pain, the likes of which he had never experienced before. Pain so intense he would have cut off his own hand to make it stop. It felt as if a red-hot poker were being pressed into his back. He could not move. He could not breathe. Even the smallest shift in position caused him unbearable torment.
Shadows fell across him, and he heard Baldur and Delwyn shouting. Then Brigman, of all people, was saying something as well, although Roran could not make sense of it. The pain suddenly increased tenfold, and he bellowed, which only made it worse. With a supreme effort of will, he forced himself to remain absolutely still. Tears ran from the corners of his clenched eyes. Then Brigman was talking to him.
"Roran, you have an arrow in your back. We tried to catch the archer, but he escaped."
"Hurts!"
Roran gasped.
"That's because the arrow hit one of your ribs. It would have gone right through you otherwise. You're lucky it wasn't an inch higher or lower, and that it missed your spine and your shoulder blade."
"Pull it out,"
he said, between gritted teeth.
"We can't. The arrow has a barbed head, and we can't push it through to the other side. It has to be cut out. I have some experience with this, Roran. If you trust me to wield the knife, I can do it here and now. Or if you prefer, we can wait until we find you a healer. There must be one or two somewhere in the palace."
Though he hated to put himself in Brigman's power, Roran could bear the pain no longer. So he said,
"Do it here. Baldur."
"Yes, Roran."
"Take 50 men and find Halsted. Whatever happens, he can't escape. Delwyn, stay with me."
A brief discussion ensued between Baldur, Delwyn, and Brigman, of which Roran heard but a few scattered words. Then a large portion of the Varden departed the atrium, which was noticeably quieter afterward. At Brigman's insistence, a team of warriors fetched chairs from a nearby room, broke them into pieces, and built a fire on the gravel-lined path next to the statue. Into the fire was placed the tip of a dagger, which Roran knew Brigman would use to cauterize the wound in his back after removing the arrow, lest he bleed to death. as he lay on the bench, stiff and trembling. Roran focused on controlling his breathing, taking slow, shallow breaths to minimize the pain. Difficult as it was, he purged his mind of all other thoughts. What had been and what might be did not matter. Only the steady inflow and outflow of air through his nostrils. He almost passed out when four men lifted him from the bench and lowered him face down to the ground. Someone stuffed a leather glove into his mouth, aggravating the ache from his torn lips, while at the same time, rough hands grasped each of his legs and arms, stretching them out to their fullest extent and pinning them in place. Roran glanced backward to see Brigman kneeling over him, holding a curved hunting knife in one hand. The knife began to descend, and Roran closed his eyes again and bit down hard on the glove. He breathed in. He breathed out. And then time and memory ceased for him. Interregnum. Roran sat hunched over the edge of the table, toying with a jewel-encrusted goblet that he stared at without interest. Night had fallen, and the only light in the lavish bedchamber came from the two candles on the desk and the small fire glowing on the hearth by the empty four-poster bed. All was quiet, save for an occasional crackle of burning wood. A faint, salty breeze wafted through the windows, parting the thin white curtains. He turned his face to catch the draught, welcoming the touch of cool air against his fevered skin. Through the windows, he could see Aros laid out before him. Watchfires dotted the streets at intersections here and there, but otherwise the city was dark and motionless. Unusually so, for everyone who could was hiding in their homes. When the breeze ceased, he took another sip from the goblet, pouring the wine directly down his throat to avoid having to swallow. A drop fell onto the split in his lower lip, and he tensed and sucked in his breath while he waited for the spike of pain to vanish. He set the goblet on the desk, next to the plate of bread and lamb and the half-empty bottle of wine, then glanced at the mirror propped upright between the two candles. It still reflected nothing but his own haggard face, bruised, blooded, and missing a goodly portion of his beard on the right-hand side. He looked away. She would contact him when she did. In the meantime, he would wait. It was all he could do. He hurt too much to sleep. He picked up the goblet again and rolled it between his fingers. Time passed. Late that night, the mirror shimmered like a rippling pool of quicksilver, causing Roran to blink and gaze at it through bleary, half-closed eyes. The teardrop shape of Nasawada's face took form before him, her expression as serious as ever. "Roran," she said by way of greeting, her voice clear and strong. "Lady Nasawada." He straightened off the table as far as he dared, which was only a few inches. "Have you been captured?" "No." "Then I take it that Khan is either dead or wounded."
"He died while fighting another magician."
"I'm sorry to hear it. He seemed a decent man, and we can ill afford to lose any of our spellcasters."
She paused for a moment.
"And what of Aros?"
"The city is ours."
Nasawada's eyebrows rose.
"Truly? I am most impressed. Tell me, how went the battle? Did everything go according to plan?"
Opening his jaw as little as he could, so as to minimize the discomfort of talking, Roran mumbled his way through an account of the past several days. From his arrival at Aros, to the one-eyed man who had attacked him in his tent, to the breaking of the dams at the mills, to how the Varden had fought their way through Aros to the palace of Lord Halstead, including Khan's duel with the enemy magician. Then Roran related how he had been shot in the back, and how Brigman had cut the arrow out of him.
"I'm lucky he was there. He did a good job of it. If not for him, I would have been next to useless until we found a healer."
He cringed inwardly, as for a second the memory of his wounds being cauterized jumped to the forefront of his mind, and he again felt the touch of hot metal against his flesh.
I hope you did find a healer to look at you.
Aye, later, but he was no spellcaster. Nasawada leaned back in her chair and studied him for a while.
I'm astonished you still have the strength to talk to me. The people of Carvajal are indeed made of stern stuff.
Afterward, we secured the palace, as well as the rest of Aros, although there are still a few places where our grip is weak. It was fairly easy to convince the soldiers to surrender once they realized we had slipped behind their lines and captured the center of the city.
And what of Lord Halstead? Did you capture him as well?
He was attempting to escape the palace when some of my men chanced upon him. Halstead had only a small number of guards with him, not enough to fight off our warriors, so he and his retainers fled into a wine cellar and barricaded themselves inside.
Roran rubbed his thumb over a ruby set in the goblet before him.
They wouldn't surrender, and I didn't dare storm the room. It would have been too costly. So I ordered the men to fetch pots of oil from the kitchens, light them on fire, and throw them against the door.
Were you trying to smoke them out?
Nasawada asked. He nodded slowly. A few of the soldiers ran out once the door burned down, but Halstead waited too long. We found him on the floor, suffocated.
That is unfortunate.
Also, his daughter, Lady Galliana. In his mind, he could still see her. Tiny, delicate, garbed in a beautiful lavender dress, covered with frills and ribbons. Nasawada frowned.
Who succeeds Halstead as the Earl of Fenmark?
Tharos the Quick.
The same who led the charge against you yesterday?
The same. It had been mid-afternoon when his men had brought Tharos before him. The small, bearded man had appeared dazed, though uninjured, and he had been missing his helm, with its flamboyant plumes. To him, Roran, who was lying belly down on a padded couch to save his back, had said, "I believe you owe me a bottle of wine."
"How have you done this?"
Tharos had demanded in response, the sound of despair ringing in his voice.
"The city was impregnable. None but a dragon could have broken our walls, and yet look what you wrought. You are something other than human, something other than—"
And he had fallen silent, unable to speak any longer.
"How did he react to the deaths of his father and sister?"
Nasawada asked. Roran leaned his head against his hand. His brow was slick with sweat, so he wiped it dry with his sleeve. He shivered. Despite the perspiration, he felt cold all over, especially in his hands and feet. He didn't seem to much care about his father. His sister, though. Roran winced as he remembered the torrent of abuse Tharos had directed at him after learning that Galliana was dead.
"If ever I get the chance, I'll kill you for this," Tharos had said. "I swear it."
"You had best move quickly, then," Roran had retorted. "Another has already claimed my life, and if anyone is going to kill me, my guess is that it'll be her."
"Roran? Roran?"
With a faint sense of surprise, he realized that Nasawada was calling his name. He looked at her again, framed in the mirror like a portrait, and struggled to find his tongue. At last, he said, "Tharos isn't really the Earl of Fenmark. He's the youngest of Halstead's 7 sons. But all of his brothers have fled or are hiding. So for the time being, Tharos is the only one left to claim the title. He makes a good envoy between us and the elders of the city. Without Khan, though, there's no way for me to tell who is sworn to Galbatorix and who isn't. Most of the lords and ladies are, I assume, and the soldiers, of course. But it's impossible to know who else." Nasawada pursed her lips.
"I see. Darth is the closest city to you. I'll ask Lady Alaris, whom I believe you've met, to send someone to Aros who is skilled in the art of reading minds. Most nobles keep one such person in their retinue, so it should be easy enough for Alaris to fulfill our request. However, when we marched for the Burning Plains, King Orin brought with him every spellcaster of note from Cirda, which means that whoever Alaris sends will most likely have no other skill with magic besides the ability to hear others' thoughts. And without the proper spells, it will be difficult to prevent those who are loyal to Galbatorix from opposing us at every turn."
While she spoke, Roran allowed his gaze to drift across the desk until it came to rest on the dark bottle of wine. "I wonder if Tharos poisoned it." The thought failed to alarm him. Then Nasawada was speaking to him again.
"Hope that you have kept tight rein over your men, and not let them run wild in Aros, burning, plundering, and taking liberties with its people."
Roran was so tired he found it difficult to marshal a coherent response. But at last he managed to say, "There are too few of us for the men to make mischief. They know as well as I do that the soldiers could retake the city if we gave them even the slightest opportunity."
"A mixed blessing, I suppose. How many casualties did you suffer during the attack?"
42. For a while, silence lay between them. Then Nasawada said,
"Did Khan have any family?"
Roran shrugged, a slight inward motion of his left shoulder.
"I don't know. He was from somewhere in the north, I think. But neither of us really talked about our lives before all of this. It never seemed that important."
A sudden itch in Roran's throat forced him to cough again and again, and he curled over the table until his forehead touched the wood, grimacing as waves of pain assailed him from his back, his shoulder, and his mangled mouth. His convulsions were so violent the wine in the goblet slopped over the rim and spilled onto his hand and wrist. As he slowly recovered, Nasawada said,
"Roran, you have to summon a healer to examine you. You're unwell, and you ought to be in bed."
"No." He wiped the spittle from the corner of his mouth, then looked up at her. "They've done all they can, and I'm no child to be fussed over." Nasawada hesitated, then dipped her head.
"As you wish."
"Now what happens?" he asked. "Am I finished here?"
"It was my intention to have you return as soon as we captured Aros. However, that was accomplished. But you're in no condition to ride all the way to Drasleona. You'll have to wait until—"
"I won't wait," Roran growled. He grabbed the mirror and pulled it toward him until it was only a few inches from his face. "Don't you coddle me, Nasawada. I can ride, and I can ride fast. The only reason I came here is because Aros was a threat to the Varden. That threat is gone now. I removed it, and I'm not about to stay here, injuries or no injuries, while my wife and unborn child sit camped less than a mile away from Murtag and his dragon." Nasawada's voice hardened for a moment.
"You went to Aros because I sent you."
Then in a more relaxed tone, she said,
"However, your point is well taken. You may return at once if you are able. There's no reason for you to ride night and day, as you did during the journey there. But neither should you dawdle. Be sensible about it. I don't want to have to explain to Katrina that you killed yourself traveling. Whom do you think I should select as your replacement when you leave Aros?"
"Captain Brigman."
"Brigman? Why? Didn't you have some difficulties with him?"
"He helped keep the men in line after I was shot. My head wasn't very clear at the time."
"I imagine not."
"And he saw to it that they didn't panic or lose their nerve. Also, he led them on my behalf while I was stuck in this miserable music box of a castle. He was the only one who had the experience for it. Without him, we wouldn't have been able to extend our control over the whole of Aros. The men like him, and he's skilled at planning and organizing. He'll do well at governing the city."
"Brigman it is, then."
Nasawada looked away from the mirror and murmured something to a person he could not see. Turning back to him, she said,
"I must admit, I never thought you would actually capture Aros. It seemed impossible that anyone could breach the city's defenses in so little time, with so few men, and without the aid of either a dragon or rider."
"Then why send me here?"
"Because I had to try something before letting Aragorn and Saphira fly so far away. And because you have made a habit of confounding expectations and prevailing where others would have faltered or given up. If the impossible were to happen, it seemed most likely that it would occur under your watch, as indeed it did."
Roran snorted softly. "And how long can I keep tempting fate before I end up dead like Khan?"
"Sneer if you want, but you cannot deny your own success. You have won a great victory for us today, Stronghammer. Or rather, Captain Stronghammer, I ought to say. You have more than earned the right to that title. I am immensely grateful for what you have done. By capturing Aros, you have freed us from the prospect of fighting a war on two fronts, which would have almost certainly meant our destruction. All of the Varden are in your debt, and I promise you, the sacrifices you and your men have made will not be forgotten.
Roran tried to say something, failed, tried again, and failed a second time, before he finally managed to say, I will be sure to let the men know how you feel. It will mean a lot to them.
Please do. And now I must bid you farewell. It is late, you are sick, and I have kept you far too long as it is.
Wait. He reached toward her and struck the tips of his fingers against the mirror. Wait, you haven't told me. How goes the siege of Drasleona?
She stared at him, her expression flat. Badly, and it shows no signs of improving. We could use you here, Stronghammer. If we don't find a way to bring this situation to an end, and soon, everything we have fought for will be lost.
Darts vergundundsmal.
You're fine, said Aragorn, exasperated. Stop worrying. There's nothing you can do about it anyway.
Saphira growled and continued to study her image in the lake. She turned her head from side to side, then exhaled heavily, releasing a cloud of smoke that drifted out over the water like a small lost thundercloud.
Are you sure?
She asked, and looked toward him.
What if it doesn't grow back?
Dragons grow new scales all the time, you know that.
Yes, but I've never lost one before.
He did not bother to hide his smile. He knew she would sense his amusement.
You shouldn't be so upset. It wasn't very big.
Reaching out, he traced the diamond-shaped hole on the left side of her snout, where the object of her consternation had so recently been ensconced. The gap in her sparkling armor was no larger than the end of his thumb, and about an inch deep. At the bottom of it, her leathery blue hide was visible. Curious, he touched her skin with the tip of his index finger. It felt warm and smooth, like the belly of a calf. Saphira snorted and pulled her head away from him.
Stop that! It tickles!
He chuckled and kicked at the water by the base of the rock he was sitting on, enjoying the sensation against the bottom of his bare feet.
It may not have been very big, she said, but everyone will notice that it's missing. How could they not? One might as well overlook a bare patch of earth on the crest of a snow-covered mountain.
And her eyes rolled forward as she tried to peer down her long snout at the small dark hole above her nostril. Aragorn laughed and splashed a handful of water at her. Then to soothe her injured pride, he said,
No one will notice, Saphira. Trust me. Besides, even if they do, they'll take it for a battle wound, and consider you all the more fearsome because of it.
You think so?
She returned to examining herself in the lake. The water and her scales reflected off each other in a dazzling array of rainbow-hued flecks.
What if a soldier stabs me there? The blade would go right through me. Perhaps I should ask the dwarves to make a metal plate to cover the area until the scale regrows.
That would look exceedingly ridiculous.
It would?
Mm-hmm.
He nodded, on the verge of laughing again. She sniffed.
There's no need to make fun of me. How would you like it if the fur on your head started falling out, or you lost one of those silly little nubs you call teeth? I would end up having to comfort you, no doubt.
No doubt, he agreed easily. But then teeth don't grow back. He pushed himself off the rock and made his way up the shore to where he had left his boots, stepping carefully to avoid hurting his feet on the stones and branches that littered the water's edge. Saphira followed him, the soft earth squishing between her talons.
You could cast a spell to protect just that spot, she said, as he pulled on his boots.
I could. Do you want me to?
I do.
He worked out the enchantment in his head, while he laced up his boots, then placed the palm of his right hand over the pit in her snout, and murmured the necessary words in the ancient language. A faint, azure glow emanated from underneath his hand as he bound the ward to her body. "There," he said when he finished. "Now you have nothing to worry about."
"Except that I'm still missing a scale."
He gave her a push on the jaw. "Come on, you. Let's go back to camp." Together, they left the lake and climbed the steep, crumbling bank behind them, Aragorn using the exposed tree roots as handholds. At the top of the rise, they had an unobstructed view of the Vardens' camp, a half-mile to the east, as well as, somewhat north of the camp, the sprawling mess of Drasleona. The only signs of life within the city were the tendrils of smoke that rose from the chimneys of many a house. As always, Thorn lay draped across the battlements above the southern gate, basking in the bright afternoon light. The red dragon looked asleep, but Aragorn knew from experience that he was keeping a close eye on the Varden, and the moment anyone began to approach the city, he would rouse himself and issue a warning to Murtagh and the others inside. Aragorn hopped onto Saphira's back, and she carried him to the camp at a leisurely pace. When they arrived, he slid to the ground and took the lead as they moved between the tents. The camp was quiet, and everything about it felt slow and sleepy, from the low, drawling tones of the warriors' conversations to the pennants that hung motionless in the thick air. The only creatures who appeared immune to the general lethargy were the lean, half-feral dogs that ranged through the camp, constantly sniffing as they searched for discarded scraps of food. A number of the dogs bore scratches on their muzzles and flanks, the result of making a foolish, if understandable, mistake of thinking they could chase and torment a green-eyed weercat as they would any other cat. When it happened, their yelps of pain had attracted the attention of the entire camp, and the men had laughed to see the dogs running away from the weercat with their tails between their legs. Conscious of the many looks he and Saphira attracted, Aragorn kept his chin high and his shoulders square, and adopted a vigorous stride in an attempt to convey an impression of purpose and energy. The men needed to see that he was still full of confidence, and that he had not allowed the tedium of their present predicament to weigh him down. "If only Murtagh and Thorn would leave," thought Aragorn, "they wouldn't have to be gone for more than a day for us to capture the city." So far, the siege of Drasleona had proven to be singularly uneventful. Nasawada refused to attack the city, for as she had said to Aragorn, "You barely managed to best Murtagh the last time you met. Do you forget how he stabbed you in the hip? And he promised that he would be stronger still when you next crossed paths. Murtagh may be many things, but I am not inclined to believe he is a liar. Strength isn't everything when it comes to a fight between magicians," Aragorn had pointed out. "No, but it's not unimportant either. Also, he now has the support of the priests of Helgrind, more than a few of whom I suspect are magicians. I won't risk letting you face them and Murtagh head-on in battle, not even with Blodgarm's spellcasters by your side. Until we can contrive to lure Murtagh and Thorn away, or trap them, or otherwise gain an advantage over them, we stay here, and we don't move against Drasleona." Aragorn had protested, arguing that it was impractical to stall their invasion, and that if he could not defeat Murtagh, what hope did she think he would have against Galbatorix? But Nasawada had remained unconvinced. They, along with Arya, Blodgarm, and all the spellcasters of Duvrangargata, had planned and plotted and searched for ways to gain the advantage Nasawada had spoken of. But every strategy they considered was flawed, because it required more time and resources than were at the Varden's disposal, or else because it ultimately failed to resolve the question of how to kill, capture, or drive off Murtagh and Thorn. Nasawada had even gone to Elva and asked her if she would use her ability, which allowed her to sense other people's pain, as well as any pain they were about to suffer in the immediate future, to overcome Murtagh, or to surreptitiously gain entrance to the city. The silver-browed girl had laughed at Nasawada and sent her away with jibes and insults, saying,
"I owe no bond of allegiance to you or anyone else, Nasawada. Find some other child to win your battles for you. I'll not do it."
And so the Varden waited. As day inexorably followed day, Aragorn had watched the men grow sullen and discontent. and Nasawada had become increasingly worried. An army, Aragorn had learned, was a ravenous, insatiable beast that would soon die and separate into its constituent elements unless massive amounts of food were shoveled into its many thousands of stomachs upon a regular basis. When marching into new territory, obtaining supplies for an army was a simple matter of confiscating food and other essentials from the people they conquered, and stripping resources from the surrounding countryside. Like a plague of locusts, the Varden left a barren swath of land in their wake, a swath devoid of most everything needed to support life. Once they stopped moving, they soon exhausted the stores of food close at hand, and were forced to subsist entirely on provisions brought to them from Sirda and the several cities they had captured. Generous as the inhabitants of Sirda were, and rich as the vanquished cities were, the regular deliveries of goods were not enough to sustain the Varden for much longer. Though Aragorn knew the warriors were devoted to their cause, he had no doubt that when faced with the prospect of a slow, agonizing death by starvation, that would accomplish nothing besides giving Galbatorix the satisfaction of gloating over their defeat, most men would elect to flee to some distant corner of Alagasia, where they could live out the rest of their lives in safety from the Empire. That moment had not yet arrived, but it was fast approaching. Fear of that fate, Aragorn was sure, was what had been keeping Nasawada up at night, so that she appeared increasingly haggard each morning, the bags under her eyes like small, sad smiles. The difficulties they had faced at Dras Leona made Aragorn grateful that Rohirrim had avoided becoming similarly bogged down at Arros, and heightened his admiration and appreciation for what his cousin had accomplished at the southern city. "He's a braver man than I." Nasawada would disapprove, but Aragorn was determined that once Rohirrim returned, which if all went well would be in a few days, Aragorn would once again provide him with a full set of wards. Aragorn had already lost too many members of his family to the Empire and Galbatorix, and he was not about to let the same doom befall Rohirrim. He paused to let a trio of arguing dwarves cross the path in front of him. The dwarves wore no helms or insignia, but he knew they were not of Durmgreist in Jeetum, for their plaited beards were trimmed with beads, a fashion he had never seen among the Injeetum. What the dwarves were quarrelling about was a mystery to him. He could not understand more than a few words of their guttural language, but the topic was obviously of all-consuming importance, judging by their loud voices, unrestrained gestures, exaggerated expressions, and their failure to notice either him or Saphira standing in the path. Aragorn smiled as they passed. He found their preoccupation somewhat comical, despite their evident seriousness. Much to the relief of everyone in the Varden, the dwarves' army, led by their new king, Oric, had arrived at Dras Leona 2 days before. That and Rohirrim's victory at Arros had since become the main topics of conversation throughout the camp. The dwarves nearly doubled the size of the Varden's allied forces, and would substantially increase the chances of the Varden reaching Urabane and Galbatorix, if a favourable solution to the impasse with Murtagh and Thorn could be found. As he and Saphira walked through the camp, Aragorn caught sight of Katrina sitting outside her tent, knitting clothes for her child-to-be. She greeted him with a raised hand, and by calling, "Cousin." He replied in kind, as had become their habit since her marriage. After both he and Saphira enjoyed a leisurely lunch, which involved a fair amount of tearing and crunching on Saphira's part, they retired to the patch of soft, sunlit grass next to Aragorn's tent. By order of Nasawada, the patch was always left open for Saphira's use, a dictate that the Varden observed with religious zeal. There Saphira curled up to doze in the midday warmth, while Aragorn fetched Domia Aberwyrda from his saddlebags, then climbed under the overhang of her left wing to nestle in the partially shaded hollow between the inner curve of her neck and her muscular foreleg. The light that shone through the folds of her wing, as well as that cast off in winking highlights from her scales, painted his skin a weird purplish hue, and covered the pages of the book with a smattering of glowing shapes that made it difficult to read the thin, angular runes. But he did not mind. The pleasure of sitting with Saphira more than made up for the inconvenience. They sat together for an hour or two, until Saphira had digested her meal, and Aragorn was tired of deciphering the convoluted sentences of Heslant the monk. Then, bored, they wandered through the camp, inspecting the defences, and occasionally exchanging words with the sentinels stationed along the perimeter. Near the eastern edge of the camp, where the bulk of the dwarves were situated, they came across a dwarf who was squatting next to a bucket of water, his sleeves rolled up past his elbows, moulding a fist-sized ball of dirt with his hands. By his feet was a puddle of mud, and a stick that had been used to stir it. The sight was so incongruous, several moments elapsed before Aragorn realized that the dwarf was Oric.
"Derundan, Aragorn, Sathira," said Oric, without looking up.
"Derundan," said Aragorn, repeating the traditional dwarvish greeting, and squatted on the other side of the puddle. He watched as Oric continued to refine the contours of the ball, smoothing and shaping it with the outer curve of his right thumb. Every so often, Oric reached down, grabbed a handful of dry dirt and sprinkled it over the yellowish orb of earth, then gently brushed off the excess. "I never thought to see the King of the Dwarves crouched on the ground, playing in the mud like a child," Aragorn said. Oric huffed, blowing out his mustache.
"And I never thought to have a dragon and a rider staring at me while I made an Eroth Nurl."
"And what is an Eroth Nurl?"
"A Thardsvergundensmal."
"A Thardsver—" Aragorn gave up halfway through the word, unable to remember the whole of it, much less pronounce it. "And that is?"
"Something that appears to be other than what it actually is."
Oric raised the ball of dirt.
"Like this. This is a stone fashioned from earth, or rather so it shall seem when I am done."
"A stone from earth? Is it magic?"
"No, it is mine own skill, nothing more."
When Oric failed to explain further, Aragorn asked, "How is it done?"
"If you are patient, you will see."
Then after a while, Oric relented and said,
"First, you must find some dirt."
"A hard task, that." From under his bushy eyebrows, Oric gave him a look.
"Some types of dirt are better than others. Sand, for example, will not work. The dirt must have particles of varying size so that it will stick together properly. Also, it should have some clay in it, as this does. But most important, if I do this..."
And he patted his hand against a bare strip of ground among the clumps of trampled grass.
"There must be lots of dust in the dirt. See?"
He held up his hand, showing Aragorn the layer of fine powder that clung to his palm. "Why is that important?"
"Ah,"
said Oric, and tapped the side of his nose, leaving behind a whitish smear. He resumed rubbing the sphere with his hands, turning it so that it would remain symmetrical.
"Once you have good dirt, you wet it, and you mix it like water and flour, until you have a nice thick mud."
He nodded at the pool by his feet.
"From the mud you form a ball, like so, eh? Then you squeeze it and wring out every drop you can. Then you make the ball perfectly round. When it begins to feel sticky, you do as I am doing. You pour dirt over it to draw out more moisture from the interior. This you continue until the ball is dry enough to hold its shape, but not so dry that it cracks. Mine, Eroth Nurl, is almost to that point. When it gets there, I shall bear it to mine tent and leave it in the sun for a goodly while. The light and warmth will draw out even more moisture from the center. Then I shall again pour dirt over it, and again clean it off. After 3 or 4 times, the outside of mine Eroth Nurl should be as hard as the hide of a Nagra."
"All that just to have a ball of dry mud?" said Aragorn, puzzled. Sephira shared his sentiment. Oric scooped up another handful of dirt.
"No, because that's not the end of it. Next is when the dust becomes of use. I take it, and I smear the outside of the Eroth Nurl with it, which forms a thin, smooth shell. Then I will let the ball rest and wait for more moisture to seep to the surface, then dust, then wait, then dust, then wait, and so on.
And how long will that take?
Until the dust no longer adheres to the Erothnirl. The shell it forms is what gives an Erothnirl its beauty. Over the course of a day, it will acquire a brilliant sheen, as if it were made of polished marble. With no buffing, no grinding, no magic, with only your heart, head, and hands, you will have made a stone out of common earth. A fragile stone, it is true, but a stone nevertheless.
Despite Oryk's insistence, Aragorn still found it hard to believe that the mud at his feet could be transformed into anything like what Oryk had described without the use of magic.
"Why are you making one, though, Oryk Dwarf King?"
Saphira asked.
"You must have many responsibilities now that you are ruler of your people."
Oryk grunted.
"I have nothing I must needs do at the moment. My men are ready for battle, but there is no battle for us to fight, and it would be bad for them if I were to fuss over them like a mother hen. Nor do I want to sit alone in my tent, watching mine beard grow. Thus the Erothnirl."
He fell silent then, but it seemed to Aragorn that something was bothering Oryk, so Aragorn held his tongue and waited to see if Oryk would say anything else. After a minute, Oryk cleared his throat and said,
"Used to be I could drink and play dice with the others of mine clan, and it mattered not that I was Hrothgar's adopted heir. We could still talk and laugh together without it feeling uncomfortable. I asked for no favours, nor did I show any. But now it is different. My friends cannot forget that I am their king, and I cannot ignore how their behaviour has changed toward me."
"That is only to be expected," Aragorn pointed out. He empathised with Oryk's plight, for he had experienced much the same thing since becoming a rider.
"Perhaps, but knowing it makes it no easier to bear."
Oryk made an exasperated sound.
"Ach, life is a strange, cruel journey sometimes. I admired Hrothgar as a king, but it often seemed to me that he was short with those he dealt with when he had no reason to be. Now I understand better why he was the way he was."
Oryk cupped the ball of dirt with both hands and gazed at it. His brow knotted in a scowl.
"When you met with Grimst Porthgannal in Tarnag, did he explain to you the significance of the Erothnirlen?"
"He never mentioned it."
"I suppose there were other matters that needed talking about. Still, as one of the Injitum, and as an adopted Nurler, you should know the import and symbology of the Erothnirlen. It is not just a way to focus the mind, pass the time, and create an interesting keepsake. No. The act of making a stone out of earth is a sacred one. By it we reaffirm our faith in Helsvarg's power and offer tribute to him. One should approach the task with reverence and purpose. Crafting an Erothnirl is a form of worship, and the gods do not look kindly on those who perform the rites in a frivolous manner. From stone, flesh, from flesh, earth, and from earth, stone again. The wheel turns, and we see but a glimpse of the entirety."
Only then did Aragorn appreciate the depth of Oryk's disquiet. "You ought to have her Vedra with you," he said. "She would keep you company, and prevent you from becoming so grim. I've never seen you as happy as when you were with her at Bregenhold." The lines around Oryk's downcast eyes deepened as he smiled.
"Aye, but she is the Grimst Carvlors of the Injitum, and she cannot abandon her duties just to comfort me. Besides, I could not rest easy if she were within 100 leagues of Murtag and Thorn, or worse, Galbatorix and his accursed black dragon.
In an attempt to cheer Auric up, Aragorn said, "You remind me of the answer to a riddle. A dwarf king sitting on the ground, making a stone out of dirt. I'm not sure how the riddle itself would go, but perhaps something along the lines of, strong and stout, 13 stars upon his brow, living stone sat shaping dead earth into dead stone. It doesn't rhyme, but then you can't expect me to compose proper verse on the spur of the moment. I would imagine that a riddle like that would be quite a head-scratcher for most people."
"Humph," said Auric. "Not for a dwarf. Even our children could solve it as quick as you please."
"A dragon, too," said Saphira.
"I suppose you're right," said Aragorn. Then he asked Auric about everything that had happened among the dwarves after he and Saphira had left Trondheim for their second trip to the Forest of the Elves. Aragorn had not had an opportunity to talk with Auric for any great length of time since the dwarves had arrived at Drasleona, and he was eager to hear how his friend had gotten along since assuming the throne. Auric did not seem to mind explaining the intricacies of the dwarves' politics. Indeed, as he spoke, his expression brightened, and it became increasingly animated. He spent nearly an hour recounting the bickering and manoeuvring that had gone on between the dwarf clans prior to assembling their army and marching to join the Varden. The clans were a fractious lot, as Aragorn well knew, and even as king, Auric had difficulty commanding their obedience.
"It's like trying to herd a flock of geese," said Auric. "They're always trying to go off on their own. They make an obnoxious noise, and they'll bite your hand first chance they get."
During the course of Auric's narration, Aragorn thought to ask about Vermund. He had often wondered what had become of the dwarf chief who had plotted to assassinate him. He liked to know where his enemies were, especially one as dangerous as Vermund.
"He returned to his home village of Felderast," Auric said. "There, by all accounts, he sits and drinks and rages about what is and what might have been. But none now listen to him. The Nurlen of Aswelden Rock Anuin are proud and stubborn. In most cases, they would remain loyal to Vermund regardless of what the other clans might do or say. But attempting to kill a guest is an unforgivable offence, and not all of Aswelden Rock Anuin hate you like Vermund does. I cannot believe that they will agree to remain cut off from the rest of their kind just to protect a Grimstborith who has lost every scrap of his honour. It may take years, but eventually they will turn against him. Already I have heard that many of the clan shun Vermund, even as they themselves are shunned."
"What do you think will happen to him?"
"He will accept the inevitable and step down, or else one day someone will slip poison into his mead, or perhaps a dagger between his ribs. By the way, he is no longer a threat to you as the leader of Aswelden Rock Anuin."
They continued to talk until Auric had finished the first few stages of shaping his Eroth Nurl and was ready to take the ball of dirt and set it to rest upon a piece of cloth by his tent to dry. As Auric rose to his feet and gathered up his bucket and stick, he said,
"I appreciate you being so kind as to listen to me, Aragorn. And you as well, Saphira. Strange as it may seem, you are the only ones, besides Saavedra, to whom I can talk freely. Everyone else..."
He shrugged.
"Bah!"
Aragorn got to his feet as well. "You're our friend, Auric. Whether you are king of the dwarves or not, we're always happy to talk with you. And you know you don't have to worry about us telling others what you've said."
"Aye, I know that, Aragorn."
Auric squinted up at him.
"You participate in the goings-on of the world, and yet you haven't gotten caught up in all the petty scheming around you."
"It doesn't interest me. Besides, there are more important things to deal with at the moment."
"That's good. A rider should stand apart from everyone else. Otherwise, how can you judge things for yourself? I never used to appreciate the rider's independence, but now I do, if only for selfish reasons.
I don't stand entirely apart, said Aragorn. I'm sworn both to you and to Nasawada.
Auric inclined his head.
True enough. But you are not fully part of the Varden, or the Ingetum either, for that matter. Whatever the case may be, I'm glad I can trust you.
A smile crept across Aragorn's face. As am I.
After all, we're foster brothers, aren't we? And brothers ought to watch each other's backs.
That they should, thought Aragorn, though he did not say it out loud.
Foster brothers, he agreed, and clapped Auric on the shoulder.
The Way of Knowing. Later that afternoon, when it seemed increasingly unlikely that the Empire would launch an attack from Dras Leona in the few remaining hours of sunlight, Aragorn and Saphira went to the sparring field at the rear of the Varden camp. There Aragorn met with Arya, as he had done every day since arriving at the city. He asked after her, and she answered briefly. She had been stuck in a tiresome conference with Nasawada and King Orin since before dawn. Then Aragorn drew his sword, and Arya hers, and they took up positions opposite each other. For a change, they had agreed beforehand to use shields. It was closer to the reality of actual combat, and it introduced a welcome element of variety into their duels. They circled each other with short, smooth steps, moving like dancers over the uneven ground, feeling their way with their feet and never looking down, never looking away from one another. This was Aragorn's favorite part of their fights. There was something profoundly intimate about staring into Arya's eyes, without blinking, without wavering, and having her stare back at him with the same degree of focus and intensity. It could be disconcerting, but he enjoyed the sense of connection it created between them. Arya initiated the first attack, and within the span of a second, Aragorn found himself standing hunched over at an awkward angle, her blade pressed against the left side of his neck, tugging painfully at his skin. Aragorn remained frozen until Arya saw fit to release the pressure and allow him to stand upright.
That was sloppy, she said.
How is it you keep besting me? He growled, far from pleased.
Because, she replied,
and fainted toward his right shoulder, causing him to raise his shield and leap backward in alarm.
I've had over 100 years of practice. It would be odd if I weren't better than you now, wouldn't it? You should be proud that you've managed to mark me at all. Few can.
Brisingamen whistled through the air as Aragorn struck at her lead thigh. A loud clang resounded as she stopped the blow with her shield. She countered with a clever twisting stab that caught him on his sword wrist and sent icy needles shooting up his arm and shoulder to the base of his skull. Wincing, he disengaged, seeking a temporary reprieve. One of the challenges of fighting elves was that because of their speed and strength, they could lunge forward and engage an enemy at distances far greater than any human could. Therefore, to be safe from Arya, he had to move nearly 100 feet away from her. Before he could put much distance between them, Arya sprang after him, taking 2 flying steps, her hair streaming behind her. Aragorn swung at her while she was still airborne, but she turned so that his sword passed along the length of her body without touching it. Then she slipped the edge of her shield underneath his and yanked it away, leaving his chest completely exposed. Fast as could be, she brought her sword up and again pressed it against his neck, this time underneath his chin. She held him in that position, her large, wide-set eyes only inches away from his. There was a ferocity and intentness to her expression that he was uncertain how to interpret, but it gave him pause. A shadow seemed to flit across Arya's face then, and she lowered her sword and stepped away. Aragorn rubbed his throat.
If you know so much about swordsmanship, he said, then why can't you teach me to be better?
Her emerald eyes burned with even greater force.
I'm trying, she said, but the problem is not here.
She tapped her sword against his right arm.
The problem is here.
She tapped his helm, metal clinking against metal.
And I don't know how else to teach you what you